Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 115 of the Gunblog Variety Cast, a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing great. My lawyer told me that the 1023 filing for Blazing Sword is now completed, which is great news. However, I have been cautioned not to discuss the specifics of the tax-deductible status of donations until I've been briefed, which hopefully will happen soon. So don't run out and send me money quite yet, but start saving up.
And if you're, say, a firearms industry professional, now would be the time to start thinking about that end-of-year tax donation, right? I'm sure the lawyer will have all of this explained to you in plenty of time for that, right, Aaron?
Oh, he'd better.
So I've got some good news, some great news, and some wondrous news this week. The good news is I voted early, so the long national nightmare is over, at least for me. Vote early, ignore often. I voted, and now I can ignore all those people who are going to try to tell me how to vote because I already voted. Ha 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 ha. The funny thing is all the people who think the other side's being big fat jerks to them throughout the whole campaign, they stood in the line next to me and were perfectly nice to everybody. I wonder what that says about all of this.
That it's been manufactured outrage?
I kind of think so, yeah. The great news is that now former Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane, D. Bloomberg, was convicted.
Yay!
Two felony counts of perjury and misdemeanor counts of conspiracy, official oppression, and false swearing. She was sentenced to between 10 and 23 months in prison, plus 8 years of probation.
Months? Oh, come on. This should be years, man.
Oh, I know. But she was handcuffed in court and led away like the criminal she is.
Yeah, she is going to have a permanent criminal record, which is good.
The picture of her in handcuffs, it was beautiful. She was given a bail of $75,000 cash while she appeals. And the wondrous news, hunting mentor Jeff, the guy who's letting me hunt on his property, the guy who is teaching me how to hunt, the guy who was teaching me how to field dress the deer.
The guy who had the heart attack last week.
The guy who had a heart attack last week. He is in great shape.
Oh, good.
Right before the podcast went live on Sunday, I got a text message from him. Hey, I'm home. I'm fine. Everything's okay. I got home on Saturday. I got your text message. It was really funny. I appreciate it. But yeah, I'm doing fine. So he's doing fantastic. They shocked him 7 times. He was dead. Heart was stopped for 2 minutes, but apparently it didn't suit him, so he came back. Doc says he can't get into a tree stand for another week, but aside from that, he's golden.
Oh, good for him.
So I went hunting yesterday. That'd be Wednesday. I didn't see a single deer. And I'm going to go out again tomorrow, which would be Friday. We'll see how that goes.
And thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support to the Gunblog Variety Cast and for providing Sean with his hunting ammunition. From Golden Saber to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
So let's kick off the rest of the show.
Alrighty. In our Pacifiers and Peacemakers segment, Beth reminds us that men's clothes are from Mars and women's clothes are from Venus, aka the Great Pocket Debate.
You know, no matter what I do and no matter where I go and ultimately no matter who I talk to, the topic of concealed carry for women seems to come up. And the reason being is just, you know, men and women were shaped very differently, we think very differently, and we certainly have different ideas about fashion, about what's comfortable, what's trendy, and what looks good on us. But it's just kind of funny to think about that, you know, we really and truly are very different, not only when it comes down to our considerations for what gun we want to use and carry, but how and where we do that. You know, in fact, during a recent chapter meeting of the Well-Armed Woman, I was talking with a member about an ankle holster that could possibly work for her in the hot, humid summer months in Alabama. You know, this is a time when she and many women prefer to wear lighter weight, form-complementing tops, and a time when the more traditional holsters don't always work. But halfway into our discussion, another trainer, a very respected Army vet, interrupted our conversation. He kind of sighed and grumbled about ankle holsters and made it very obvious that he didn't approve or agree with my recommendations. In fact, he basically discounted the idea of an ankle holster at all. He thought that was a really bad idea. For one, he said you can't get to it fast enough. For two, he said that there's not very many holsters that are going to be very comfortable, accessible, safe, and that are actually going to sit where they're supposed to and not move. Well, then he walked over to his truck and retrieved a small pistol, a Taurus 738 TCP, and he told us that all we women really needed in order to conceal carry effectively was a small gun. Well, of course, there's nothing wrong with small guns, and I have a few. And, you know, most of us know that the smaller the gun, the more recoil likely we're going to struggle with. Luckily, this other lady was familiar with that and was confident enough with her skills that she could certainly carry that Taurus. But although I smiled at the gentleman, while also kind of cringing inside, knowing that a lot of men just don't really understand the struggles women have, blending tactical holsters with fashionable wardrobes. After all, bodies, styles, needs, clothing, they're worlds apart. But I politely watched and listened as he demonstrated and touted the strengths of the compact gun, and then easily slipped the Taurus into the pocket of his pants. He smiled and nodded at the two of us, pleased that he'd proven what he believed to be the better way for my friend, and I guess for women in general, to carry a firearm, even when the temperatures increase and the clothing options decrease, potentially. But I had to step in and let him know why this particular example would not work for us. I pointed out that his pockets and his attire worked perfectly for effectively holding and hiding a small gun. But the pockets on my jeans were barely 3 inches deep. And my friend, who looked at her pockets, found that hers too were very shallow, too shallow to encase or cover even the smallest pocket pistol. Now, at this point, I could tell that my fellow trainer was very surprised and kind of unsure what to do with this revelation and this realization. He raised his eyebrows and lowered his gaze in the direction of my jeans, shaking his head and mumbling his disapproval and disappointment. He then admitted that he'd never run into that kind of problem before. I shrugged my shoulders and smiled and reiterated that women and women's clothing are just different. With a laugh and a nod of agreement, he offered his final suggestion. Just head down to Bass Pro Shops and pick up some tactical duty pants. Well, again, that's great and wonderful. I mean, I definitely have my share of 5'11 strike pants. I love them for teaching, training, just for being out there on the range, but honestly, these are not the things that I typically wear on a day-to-day basis. I tend to gravitate toward the more quote-unquote normal clothing options. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there as something for people to think about. While it might be easy or intuitive or second nature for a lot of guys to just grab a small pistol and throw it in a pocket of a jacket or jeans or a vest or whatever the case may be, for women, we really have to be more clever and creative. We really have to think of all the different things working against us. But ultimately, I'm not one to say that we should sacrifice fashion. Now, granted, I'm much more willing to compromise fashion to be safe with firearms and to be able to carry. But we have to consider that options are going to be so different, so unique, and so just refined to each person that it's nearly impossible for us to say, you know what? This one works perfectly for me, and it's probably going to work perfectly for you. So for everyone out there, just work with what works for you, to each her own, if you will. And hopefully you will find not only the gun, but the holster option that fits for you, and you won't have to try jamming it into pants pockets that are just way too shallow. So thanks again, guys. Until next time, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This subject really speaks to me, Sean. As someone who has walked both sides of the sartorial fence, I can state that holsters are far more friendly to masculine clothes than to feminine, and while I can understand why people recommend against purse carry, I can also understand why so many women see it as their best or only option.
I can understand that.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the Donate or Subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Police officer, Gastonia Man Tried to Kill Me. A Gastonia man is in jail on a charge of attempted first-degree murder after police say he tried to run over an officer with a stolen car. Gastonia officer A. Lopera found suspect 23 with a suspected stolen 2010 Chevrolet Impala on Sunday. The car was reportedly worth $8,000, according to arrest reports. The officer had pulled suspect over near the 1200 block of East Cedar Avenue around 2 a.m. near exit 19 of Interstate 85, Gastonia police spokeswoman Donna Lazar said. The stop was about 4 miles from the home address suspect would later give police. Lopera walked out of his police car. At one point, suspect punched the gas. Lopera jumped out of the way to avoid getting struck by the Chevrolet, which was later found abandoned less than a mile away on Hancock Street, Lazar said. Suspect was booked into the Gaston County Jail around 2 p.m. Monday. He's held without bond on charges of attempted first-degree murder, stealing a car, possessing half an ounce of marijuana, and possessing wrapping papers, a form of marijuana paraphernalia.
Now, I have a question here, because first-degree murder requires premeditation, I thought. And this sounded like this was very much a heat-of-the-moment, what-the-heck, go for it, try to run over the officer, which I would have thought would be second-degree murder.
Premeditation only requires that you decide to do it ahead of time, right? Premeditation can happen instantly. It would require a lawyer to explain.
Okay, I get it.
But you may be right. It may be just overcharging the guy.
So, who was our choir boy?
Communicating threats, misdemeanor class 1. Assault with a deadly weapon, misdemeanor class A1. 3 counts, deliver cell, schedule 4, felon class I. Possess controlled substance, felon class H. 3 counts, cell, schedule 4, felon class H. And assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury, felon class E.
So that's certainly not the first time he's assaulted someone with a deadly weapon.
Certainly not his first time at the rodeo.
No.
These Internet of Things botnets are getting out of hand. First it was Krebs, and now it's the backbone of the Internet, the domain name servers. People in many places couldn't access major parts of the Internet. How did it happen? And what can we do about it? Barron tells us in
Tech Tips.
Tech Tips. Tech Tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech Tips with the Barron.
Barron, what happened this week in the world of tech?
Well, Sean, a couple weeks ago, I talked about a distributed denial of service attack against Krebs on Security. That botnet behind the attack came back again, this time against something a bit more useful. First, let me discuss some underlying tech and the history that's happened since the Krebs attack. Shortly after the attack on Krebs, the source code was released that would allow anyone to create a botnet out of the devices used in the attack. It would seek out these devices and add them into their zombie network. Due to the device structure, there isn't much at the device level that can be done to keep these people out. The devices in question are cameras and DVRs, not the DVRs that you think of with regards to your cable box, mind you, but DVRs that people normally use in security systems. It turns out that some deep research showed that all of these cameras and DVRs source their parts from the same firm in China.
So people were buying compromised chips?
Not exactly. Think of it as a company was producing hardware and firmware, and everyone was slapping their own brand labels on it. Well, the firmware for the product coming out of China had set in stone the root password and opened the SSH and telnet ports. This is a security fail beyond measure.
That's like shipping every single Toyota with the same key fob code.
Exactly. Now, onto the underlying tech. Everyone who has touched the internet is somewhat familiar with the domain name system. This is what allows you to go to gunblogvarietycast.com instead of remembering 104.28.5.39. What happens when you type that in is a request is made to resolve the name into an IP address. This starts at your computer, goes to your DNS resolvers. If they don't know the answer, they start at the end and work backwards, finding whoknows.com and then asking .com where they can find Gunblog Varietycast. Along each step, this information will be cached, so the next time someone asks, the response will be quicker. This cache value expires after some set time. This is because IP addresses can change, sometimes very quickly, to aid in load balancing and request distribution.
Well, this makes sense. If you already know the answer, there's no sense asking again. But if it's been a while, you probably should check back to see if anything's changed.
Exactly, Sean. And that's where we now get into the nastiness that was a denial of service attack against a part of the critical infrastructure of the internet, Dyn, who some of our users might be familiar with from their dynamic DNS product. They also do DNS service for some major websites, including Reddit, CNN, Imgur, and Netflix, for example. Early in the morning, the botnet started making resolver requests headed into Dyn's network. To escape the caching problem, they would prefix a new subdomain to every request.
For example, www1.reddit.com. The next request was www2.reddit.com, and so forth. This saturated the incoming bandwidth and the server availability.
So what? Didn't you just say that the local servers remembered the addresses in something that you just called a cache?
Only until the cache times out. Slowly, one by one, things expire in different caches, and sites started to fail to resolve. Dyn, however, was able to get this first attack under control, and service returned to normal. Then, the second wave hit. This time, the issue spread out of just the Northeast, and resolution issues spread basically to the major tech centers as the caches timed out again. End result, slowly more places cannot find where to find sites that resolve through Dyn. This resulted in the world coming to a crashing halt for me and some of my coworkers. We make use of a site known as GitHub. For those who don't know, GitHub, along with Stack Exchange, are vital to the software development universe. Open source tools and projects rely on GitHub as the central point for updates and coordination between people working on projects. GitHub allows teams to make changes to code in different areas at the same time without ending up with different programs in different places. Suddenly, our computers can no longer find GitHub. Basically, without GitHub, my team trying to write code for a project would be about as successful as a half dozen drunks playing ping pong in the dark.
In other words, the internet was down.
Not really. The internet was actually still alive and well. One of the services that supports it and makes it convenient was ground to a halt in some corners. If you knew the IP address, you could still get out to the service manually. Don't misunderstand. It definitely felt that way since you could go to Netflix.com and it would fail to resolve. Getting an error when everything on your end is working certainly could feel like the internet has broken.
So you're saying that the information superhighway was still there. It's just that some jerk ripped down all the road signs?
That's exactly right, Sean. The good news is the internet is designed to be resilient. The problem is that there are parts that are not nearly as resilient as they should be, though they are certainly better than they were at the very beginning.
So how can we fix this?
That's a bit harder, Sean. A few people have mentioned maintaining a full copy of the DNS listing locally. The thing is, the .com directory alone was over 2 gigabytes in 2013, and it's only been growing. Second, it won't reflect changes quickly. This is actually what was done way back in the day and why we now have DNS. It doesn't scale and has some serious issues in itself. There are a few discussions happening to fix things, but the big item is to make sure you're not contributing to the problem. If you haven't already, search your router settings and disable Universal Plug and Play. Note, this will make things a bit more difficult since you will have to manually configure port access, but for the most part, things on the internet shouldn't need to be tunneling into your network. Universal Plug and Play makes it easy for devices to do that. If you have IP cameras or DVRs, pull them off any network connected to the internet. Just don't connect them where they can get to the net. Some companies are actually starting to issue a recall on this equipment, but don't plan on everyone sending their stuff back. Sadly, we're going to be living with this for a while. The world has been built upon the current system, and there's a lot of dependency. Adoption for replacement technologies will be slow, but we need to wail on companies that release products that, in the grand scheme, endangers the rest of us.
All right, Baron. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
Main topic. So, Aaron, how many guns are there in the United States?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom says it's about 300 million, but that's one of those numbers that's just been quoted and quoted and, you know, you can't really find a source for it. It's the number because it's the number people say.
I know. And that's one of those things that I've always wondered, where did that number come from? And I mean, it really is. It's the number because it's the number. So Hog Knows at Weapons Man blog decided maybe we should take a closer look at this number. And what if I told you that there was an ATF system that said since 1999, there were 252 million guns logged in this system by not all of the manufacturers, importers, and wholesalers in the United States, but only, I guess, a significant sample, a significant portion of those manufacturers, importers, and wholesalers.
But gee, 252 million, that's almost the 300 million we were told that was just in all of the United States. How could, in just 16 years, a fraction of gun manufacturers make brand new guns that Now account for what we have in the United States.
Even if it's a significant fraction, even if it was 90%, even if it was 100%, and that was, I don't even think that number, if I was reading correctly, that includes 2016. I think that's just up to the end of 2015 was 252 million. And these are all like unique serial numbers, right? There's no way for any of these numbers to be like the same 100 million guns counted three times. It's 252 million unique firearms.
Yeah.
The 300 million, clearly, unless there were less than 50 million guns in existence, and this was every single firearm, which we know it's not, there's no possible way there were only 50 million guns in existence in 1999, and we've manufactured the other remaining 252 million. I mean, it's just a silly number.
Yeah, it's very silly.
The ATF system is called Access 2K or Access 2000 or A2K. The participants are 66 FFLs. Some of them are wholesalers. Some of them are large manufacturers. So there's going to be a significant fraction. But as of October of 2015, not like the beginning of October, there were 252,433,229 records representing one firearm each. That's more than a quarter of a billion firearms in 15 years. So 300 million, not remotely possible as a valid number. It's not even close. It can't possibly be close.
Yeah. I mean, if you can manufacture a quarter of a billion guns in 15 years, and the United States has been manufacturing guns for civilian purchase for how long now?
How long has the country been in existence? Plus how many years before that?
Yeah. There's a lot more than that.
And figure, I mean, guns don't really honestly wear out. There's a point where you just don't use them anymore. But let's face it, the rifle that I shot a deer with, I got when I was 15. It's 32 years old come Christmas. It works just fine. You'd never know that it was 32 years old.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're shooting it so much that you're gonna wear out the barrel, in which case you replace the barrel. That's one reason why a lot of people purchase firearms for investment purchases, because you buy a new car, you drive it off the lot. That sucker's already depreciated by what? How much? Just because you went a block?
I don't know.
But a gun.
20%?
At least, if not more.
Seriously.
But a gun, you buy that thing and it retains its value for years, for decades. And of course, you can keep using it because unlike a car, which has this tendency to fall apart, guns, at least in my opinion, seem to be made to tighter tolerances because, you know, they can blow up and hurt people. So, yeah, they're rugged.
And most people don't use them all that much.
Yeah, as opposed to your car, which you're going to use every day going back and forth to work.
Seriously. Most people, really, if you're going to buy a used gun, I think Tam jokes that most people's used guns come back with the box of ammo they were purchased with. So, I mean, guns are durable goods.
Well, actually, this is true. The very first pistol that I got was my mom's old Ruger Bearcat, which she bought in 1950-something or other. And I kid you not, in the box was another box of 22 hollow point. And I don't know how old those rounds were, but they looked old. They looked like they were 50 years old.
Yeah. Other things, looking through this article, he spoke with one manufacturer who refused to be attributed. He didn't want his name out there. Shipped 100,000 80% lowers the previous year. That's 100,000 ghost guns.
Ooh, ghost guns.
And there's like 10 other manufacturers in the same boat as that guy. So even if like 20% of those million ghost lowers actually got made.
Yeah, that's 200,000.
And all the drugs that are coming in over our borders, how many guns could come in? I mean, like, it's a drop in the bucket to the legally sold firearms that there are. But, I mean, seriously, it's still, I mean, even a tiny percentage of the enormous number of guns that are actually sold is still a lot. So what does this tell us about the scale of the problem for anybody who wants to ban firearms, who wants to limit access to firearms, who someday wants to say, maybe we should reduce the number of firearms that are owned by Americans?
Good luck getting that genie back into the bottle.
Yeah, good luck with that.
So, this discussion reminds me of a line of dialogue from the 2005 movie Lord of War. Let me play that for you.
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
I think by this point, we should change the question to, how do we arm the other 8?
What happens when a typical anti-gunner gives a non-typical response to a shooting? Tiffany reaches back to a previous episode to talk about how the words of this pro-gun control journalist give her hope that because we all want basically the same things, we can find some common ground.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
Hey guys, I hope everybody's doing well and having a wonderful day. I just wanted to kind of backtrack a little bit this week and go back to something that we discussed in episode 110, I believe it was, The Good Samaritan. This, if you recall, there was an incident in I believe it was a Walmart parking lot in Oklahoma. The incident involved two different Good Samaritans who intervened when a woman and her child, her baby, it was an infant actually, were attacked in the parking lot by two assailants. The first Good Samaritan approached and intervened and he was unarmed, and the second Good Samaritan intervened and he was armed, and he managed to shoot one of the assailants, and the second assailant ran off but was later captured. The first Good Samaritan, who was not armed, he ended up being shot by the assailants. He survived. All the good guys are doing just fine now. But we took a moment in episode 110 to kind of tease out that incident. Here's just a quick replay of some of the news coverage from that day.
My brother was in the wrong. And I will, no matter what anybody says, no matter how I feel about him being gone, I will always openly admit that he was wrong for what he did.
Kayla Blackman's life changed forever Sunday. Her brother, John Simmons, one of two men, Shawnee police say, attacked a mother with a child, who we now know is a Johnson County paramedic, until a Good Samaritan named Joshua Owens stepped in to help. An Air Force veteran shot three times in the nose, wrist, and chest, trying to help. His 15-year-old daughter, Haley, telling us in part, "To me, my dad is a hero. He risked his life trying to save someone else's. I love him with all of my heart, and I'm so thankful he's going to be fine. That mom also going to be okay."
We are so sorry for everyone that is affected by this. We hate the fact that they have to go home traumatized. Their life has changed.
After Joshua was shot, police say a second Good Samaritan pulled his weapon, killing Kayla's brother. Now she's hoping this scene will inspire others to clean up their lives and get the help they need.
My brother was on drugs. He was hurting. He was hurting bad. And in reaction to doing those drugs, this incident happened. And it's not right. And we have to stop it. We have to stop it.
I wanted to revisit this story just because there were a few more points that we didn't have time to cover in episode 110. And so I thought we'd kind of do a throwback and talk a little bit more about the Walmart incident. When we first discussed the story, I did a Google search to try and find more information. And I came across a blog post by a gentleman named Jimmy Fitzpatrick, I think is his name. Now, let me just say at the onset, I don't know this person, don't know anything about him or his background. I understand from his blog that he's a journalist. Seems like a perfectly fine gentleman, but beyond reading this one blog post, I have no idea about this person, never met him, don't know anything about it. But his post was really interesting and I just wanted to share it. So one of the first things he says is this: "I'm a proponent of stricter gun control laws and would never buy a gun for self-protection. I've just seen and heard of too many incidents where guns purchased for protection end up killing family members or innocent people, like Trayvon Martin in the infamous Florida case." That's his opening statement. Okay, so right then I'm thinking, I know exactly what this guy is going to say. He's going to crap all over the Second Amendment. He's going to talk about how Don't be fooled by the seemingly positive results of this encounter. The fact that he had a gun was not a good thing. Blah, blah, blah. Guns are bad. People with guns are bad. Yada, yada. This is what I know I'm about to read from this gentleman. But I keep reading. And his very next sentence is this. However, I have to admit, it was heartening to see that a good Samaritan with a gun was able to shoot and kill a robber outside of a Shawnee Walmart Sunday afternoon. This blogger admits that despite his aversion to firearms, he was relieved to know that a private citizen was armed on that day and able to thwart this attack. So that was so heartening to me to see that. I was so excited to read that he had admitted this. So of course I kept reading. And there's obvious skepticism there about firearms still, which is not surprising given his opening. But at the end, check this out. First of all, he talks about how crime has been rising in the area, blah, blah, blah. Then he says this, these cases should serve as a reminder that we cannot take our safety for granted, regardless of where we live or how safe the places we go might seem to be. Now, I have no doubt that this gentleman is not a convert, right? I'm sure he's still very much anti-gun. But that statement could have just as easily come from the mouth of a Tom Givens or a Masoud Ayoub or a John Farnham as it did from this anti-gun blogger. And I just breathed such a huge sigh of relief when I read that because it was further confirmation of what I've always said and what I always preach and what our listeners are probably sick to death of hearing me say by now, which is we're not nearly as different as we sometimes seem to be or as we sometimes think we are. For the most part, obviously there are exceptions to every rule, but in my experience, anecdotally, anti-gunners usually want the exact same things that gunners want. They want to be safe, they want to feel secure, and here I think is a prime example of that. So while this person may not, as a result of this story, end up running out to a gun store and buying a gun, at least he has some common ground with a person like me who never leaves her house without a firearm. We have the same goal in mind. We may reach that goal by different ways. In his world, with his politics and his personal beliefs, here's how he decides to reach that goal. He says, I'm usually pretty careful, but it's easy to become complacent, as I think I have. After this weekend's upheaval, I'm going to start paying closer attention to what's going on around me and who's around me when I'm out and about. That is a win, I think, for, if not the Second Amendment proper, it's certainly a win for the principles undergirding the Second Amendment. And so for that, I am grateful to this gentleman, even if he never, ever wears a gun. I hope that all of my fellow gunnies out there can see the value in anti-gunners who at least share that sentiment that we all have a right to feel secure and we all have a responsibility to do whatever's in our power to protect and ensure that security for ourselves and our families. I think this is inroads. I mean, I see this as positive. And again, I'm not so naive as to think that this gentleman is about to go out and arm himself. But if I ever were to have a conversation with him, sit down and have a cup of coffee with him, this would be where I would start in terms of common ground. There's one other suggestion that I'd like to make for anyone who's kind of on the fence about this whole gun debate thing, or anyone who possibly like this gentleman whose blog post I ran across on the internet, who consider themselves to be generally against guns, but who are willing to accept the possibility that they can come in handy and be used for good. They're not all bad, right? If you're in that camp, I would challenge you to do the work to educate yourself on the full spectrum of pros and cons, right? Before you settle on an opinion one way or the other. Just make sure you're getting the full story on both sides. Because you may recall from episode 110 that I found this story from a friend of mine's Facebook feed, Jack Barrett. I happened to see it on his Facebook page. If it weren't for the sheer coincidence that I happened to know Jack Barrett and the sheer coincidence that this happened to occur in his hometown and the sheer coincidence that he and I are Facebook friends and I caught it on his feed, I myself would never have seen this story. It's not the kind of thing that is newsworthy in the same way that tragic events involving guns are deemed to be newsworthy. If you're just going by what makes the cut to be on the 7 o'clock news on CNN or Fox or any of the national outlets, remember that there's usually a lot more anecdotal evidence than what makes the cut to be at the 7 o'clock news hour. Sometimes you'll need to jump on Google and just run a quick search for Good Samaritan firearm or concealed carry permit holder fends off attacker or whatever. You know, pop that into Google and I bet you'd be surprised at just how often good people, well-meaning people who may otherwise be completely averse to violence manage, despite their reluctance, to employ firearms in ways that are extremely constructive, as in preserving the life of a young mother and her baby. So don't be shy about doing the work. Dig in there and see what you find. I bet you'll surprise yourself. Now, before I go, I have one more quick point about this story. I couldn't let this story go without giving a great big shout out to Miss Kayla Blackman. Now, Kayla Blackman is the young lady who was interviewed in the news story about this tragic incident. She is the sister of one of the assailant who was shot dead by Good Samaritan number 2. The reason why I'm shouting out Kayla Blackman is because she got on the news, went on TV, went on camera at what must have been, I don't know, you know, 2 or 3 days, if that, after her brother was killed. And what did she say? She didn't say guns are bad. She didn't say society has done my brother wrong. She didn't say police are bad. She didn't say everybody's against us. No, she said, no matter how sad I am about losing my brother, I am the first to admit that he was wrong. And she apologized to all the families who've been affected by her brother's actions. Now, I just think that takes a tremendous amount of courage, strength, selflessness. And when people stand up and are willing to accept accountability like that, even vicariously for members of their family who are now gone, you know, members over whom they are now in mourning, it's just commendable. And we don't spend enough time giving shout outs to people like that, because she could just as easily have refused that interview or said, you know, well, he didn't have to kill my brother, or, you know, he could have shot him in the kneecap, or, you know, something like that. She could have reacted in any number of ways, but instead she said, nope, my brother made a bad decision and he paid the price for it. So I just have to say, kudos to Kayla. Your brother did a really bad thing, but you, homegirl, are my hero of the week. Good on you. Kudos. Hear, hear. Kayla Blackman, everybody. Hero of the week. Mad respect for her. And in spite of this horrible incident, I really hope that Ms. Blackman goes on to lead a wonderful, productive, fulfilling life. Okay, so on that happy note, I'll wish everybody a wonderful week. Enjoy yourselves, be safe, and keep it centered and even.
You can follow Tiffany at frontsightpress.com.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, everypony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette!
So I've mentioned in previous segments that we call ourselves preppers because the previous term, survivalists, was co-opted by fanatical, racist, and separatist movements. And while the term prepper isn't yet a bad word, despite the best efforts of National Geographic and their execrable Doomsday Preppers show, given the recent political climate and continuing belief that anyone who keeps guns and supplies is looking for an excuse to start a civil war, we may still have that in our future. As an aside, if we ever do need to stop calling ourselves preppers, I suggest we start telling people that we're fans of The Walking Dead. Given that it's the number one show on TV right now, they probably won't ask any more questions. But on to the point of my segment. While our lifestyle hasn't yet been tagged with a radical political affiliation, it's something to look out for among members of our prepping circle or bug out group, to whom I shall refer from now on as our tribe. Just recently, I discovered that someone who I had been Facebook friends with has recently jumped on the pro-fascism bandwagon, and his wall was full of slogans like nationalist pride and quotes praising Mussolini and pictures of people in black shirts with red armbands and lightning bolts everywhere. So many lightning bolts. The kind that looks suspiciously like an S. And then I looked a bit harder and I found a picture of him wearing a t-shirt with the Waffen-SS Death's Head on it. Now, it's very easy to miss these kinds of things on Facebook because if you have more than a dozen friends, it's impossible to keep track of everything they put on their walls. If you're like me, you mainly just get by with what scrolls down your newsfeed. But while it's okay for this kind of oversight to happen on Facebook, it's another thing entirely when that person is part of your tribe for whatever reason, because they're going to be associating with you, and therefore you are going to be associated with them in the eyes of onlookers. And really, all it takes is one neo-Nazi in a prepping group to tarnish all of your reputations and make every prepper look like a paranoid, hateful racist. Now, I hope this segment doesn't come across as me sounding like I'm saying you must carefully watch your tribe for signs of wrongthink, because that's not what I want. What I am saying is that you need to make sure that you know what your other tribe members are saying and doing and believing. Back in 2011, there was a warning put out by the FBI for store owners to be watchful for people purchasing things like weatherproofed ammunition, MREs, night vision devices, and the like, as well as people who insisted on paying for such purchases with cash, because these were indications that this person might be a potential terrorist. And naturally, these are things that hunters and preppers buy, and many folks still pay for things with cash because it's, you know, legal tender. And we preppers resented being lumped in with terrorists just because we bought gear which might be used to aid in a plot. And, well, the same holds true here, only more so. We don't want the prepping movement to be lumped in with racists and fascists and Nazis either. So keep an eye out for this kind of behavior in your tribe. If you notice it, talk to that person about it. Let them know that you care about them and that you think they're headed down a dangerous path and that they ought to reconsider their life choices. And hopefully, with love and support, you can rescue that person. But if you can't, you probably ought to let them go. You don't want to be considered a racist or a fascist by proxy, and you certainly don't want any additional scrutiny by law enforcement because you're a known associate of a Nazi. So keep an eye on your tribe and make sure everyone is on an even keel. Like my mom says, who your friends are reflects on you. And not only is this true, but it's also true that whoever you prep with reflects on the prepper movement. So please don't let our culture be overrun with Nazis. I really don't want to change my segment's name to Blue Collar Walking.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey appears on Boston Public Radio again to extol the virtues of her extra-constitutional gun ban and the other merits of gun control in This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
If Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey would stop doing illegal things and telling the public how awesome it was, I wouldn't have to do this. But again, here she is on Boston Public Radio, and of course she's going to be talking about gun control.
You did a deal with Gabby Giffords. She was in Boston, the former congresswoman, of course, was shot. What was that about?
Well, Congresswoman Giffords, who's such a profile and courage and resiliency, was in town the other day. She's going around the country on a tour to amplify the voices of the majority of Americans who support common sense reforms. This is an effort to really address issues of gun safety and gun violence prevention, and I'm very supportive of both.
Wow! Count the whoppers! Number one, Congresswoman Giffords isn't doing anything political. She's a woman who suffered a traumatic and serious brain injury, who's now being dragged around by her sociopathic husband and being puppeted to speak his mind. If you think that's a bit far-fetched, watch any interview with Congresswoman Giffords after her injury, and you will find her only making very simple non-political statements, or you'll find interviews where her husband Mark Kelly does all the talking, Or you will see a spectacle like I have linked down in the show notes, where Mark Kelly is all but moving her mouth to get her to make an anti-gun speech. Number two, Mark Kelly is not doing anything common sense. He's calling for the same tired anti-gun crap that is both unenforceable and has been proven to do nothing to stop violent crime or make Americans safer in any way. Number three, these political actions aren't even supported by a majority of Americans. Any attempt to push similar regulations on the federal level fail miserably, and ballot initiatives fail as often as they succeed. And when they pass, it's by a narrow margin. Hell, Gabby Giffords doesn't even support any of this crap, back when she could still care for herself and give speeches unaided. How's that for an opening statement?
The fact of the matter is, right now we are in a time where the majority of Americans want common sense reform. What am I talking about? Things like universal background checks. Whether you're buying a gun through a private sale or at a gun show or through a dealer or online, let's have a basic background check in place.
Besides this not being something supported by a majority of Americans, it's also a law in effect in Massachusetts. And what happened when Massachusetts enacted this law? Crime went up.
And the majority of Americans get that. It's also why they support no fly, no buy.
Anybody who supports adding the so-called terror watch list to the NICS database either wants it so they can abuse the system for political reasons, or they are completely ignorant about the effectiveness of the terror watch list. As far as I can tell, the list contains zero actual terrorists, and it's entirely populated by innocent Americans. This list should be scrapped, not expanded into more avenues of our lives.
It's also about trying to move forward a conversation about this as an issue of public health and of consumer safety. It's why I went to the White House earlier this year and pushed for Congress to actually fund studies of gun violence, because I think that through that we could identify some better strategies around intervention and gun violence prevention.
Whoa, another cluster of whoppers. Public health? Well, what virus or bacteria causes gun violence? Maybe it's a genetic syndrome. Consumer safety? Accidental gun deaths and injuries have fallen so low that they're at the statistical noise level. So mission accomplished there. And funding gun violence studies? Well, we already did that in 2013, and it strongly pointed out that defensive gun uses were more common than malicious gun injuries. So President Obama and the Democratic Party pretended it never happened.
And we need to enforce the laws that are on our books. One thing that you mentioned was our enforcement around the assault weapons ban.
Right.
To be clear, this is not new regulation. This is not new lawmaking. This is enforcement of existing laws. The NRA and the gun lobby for years have said to us, we don't need new laws. We don't need new regulations. Just enforce the ones that are on the books. That's exactly what I did.
Because they were banned here, what, 98,
they were banned.
I think.
The 1998 law banned the sale of assault weapons and banned copycat versions of those weapons.
So this is a partial truth. Yes, she's claiming that her new actions against so-called assault weapons in the Commonwealth is pre-existing law. Only this is the exact same law that was enforced by all 50 states from 1994 to 2004 and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts from 1998 to 2016. And all that time, all those attorneys general, as well as the ATF and the firearms industry, all agreed how the law worked. And Mara Healey sees it differently. Either she's the greatest legal mind in the country, or she's abusing her power. Does the fact that she directly references parts and features of firearms, as well as makes and models that appear nowhere in the existing law text, point to any conclusions to you?
Over time, since then, manufacturers have made new models of assault weapons. Turns out 10,000 of them were sold here last year in the state. And we looked at the law and said, it's black and white. You can't sell assault weapons. And so we sent notice letting them know that we were going to enforce that law. And the good news today is that sales of assault weapons have virtually stopped in this state. We're the only state in the country that can say that.
Again, they were complying with the law. The ATF, as well as the past attorneys general of this and every other state, agreed to this. Further, if she knows the number of illegal guns sold, why can't she share the exact criteria she used to come up with that number? Also, sales have stopped not because they're complying with the law, but they are being crushed under the boot of government tyranny. Mara Healey has been intentionally vague at what her new definition of a copycat assault weapon is, so that nobody in this state is sure which semi-auto firearms that accept detachable magazines are legal. They also know that if the AG challenges their sale of a legal rifle, they can have their license suspended until the dispute is settled in court. This could take months or years, and if the judge rules that the shop was in the right, they have no recourse for lost sales or business. This is not law and order. This is a crime racket.
And they also say that if you already have one of these so-called copycat guns, you're facing a 10-year prison term. Is that true?
Absolutely false. This is more propaganda, mischaracterization, pumped out there by Goal and others. In fact, we made it very clear when we announced our enforcement action and sent the notice out that we weren't going to go after those who had purchased assault weapons, believing that it was okay to do so.
But she's only enforcing existing law, meaning that her interpretation of the assault weapons ban has always been the correct way. And any shop that sold a ban-compliant rifle can indeed be charged, as can the citizens who bought said rifles. Her enforcement notice is legally binding. Her declaration that the notice will only be enforced for actions after June 20th, 2016 has no such legal bindings. There is absolutely nothing stopping her from changing her mind. Nor is there anything she could do if a police officer went against her wishes and started arresting people for guns they owned before the notice. It's a crime, and since Massachusetts has a variation of universal background checks, they have us dead to rights.
What do you do if you have one of these copycat guns? What do you do with it?
Well, you have one of these guns, and you know you can't if you're going to try to sell it or transfer it. There are ways to do that, but it can't be done in state.
Gee, she makes that sound so easy. Except as far as I know, only Maryland has a similar law to what we thought we had back before June. Any place else has more restrictions or less restrictions. Meaning if you have what you thought was a Massachusetts-compliant rifle, either you can't sell it to another state, or they're going to want some deep discounts for your silly nerfed rifle.
You see within New England the consequence of there not being some basic federal rules in place. 50% of the guns that turn up in crimes here in Massachusetts actually come from other states.
So first, she's almost right. It's about 40% of traced firearms come from other states. But the average time to crime is almost 14 years. Just because a gun traces outside the state doesn't imply criminal acts. I have guns that I own completely legally, even taking this foolish enforcement at full faith, and they would trace to states other than Massachusetts. Plus, people move, and their firearms move with them. Also, what Mara fails to mention about New England is we have Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, three of the most gun-friendly states in the Union. Seriously, they make Texas and North Carolina look like California and New York. And those three states have astoundingly low crime rates, violent or otherwise. And then there's Massachusetts and Connecticut. Two states with insane gun laws and huge violent crime problems. Even tiny Rhode Island is a war zone compared to northern New England, and it too puts heavy restrictions on lawful gun owners. And Mara Healy wants to make us more like violent dumps like New York, New Jersey, California, and Illinois, rather than peaceful, idyllic states like Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. There's a reason why we call this segment This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com.
Plug of the week, Armed Lutheran Radio, another podcast on the Self-Defense Radio Network. Now, this is, as it sounds, a very religious-oriented firearms podcast, and it's kind of odd. I'm not very religious myself, but I do enjoy listening to it. It's a pretty conservative podcast, so don't look for a very much liberal worldview out of it, in case you happen to be one of the liberal listeners of this podcast. What I like about them is they have regular contributors who have actual training from a seminary. I get really angry when I hear non-Christians mangle out-of-context scriptural quotations so they can tell Christians that they're doing their own religion wrong, and these guys will give you the context. On last week's episode, they talked about voting. Lloyd, the host, talked about voting for your neighbor. He quoted a guy named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's a German Lutheran pastor and an anti-Nazi who was executed right before the end of World War II. The quote contrasts well with the words of so many people who keep saying how they want to keep their hands clean. Bonhoeffer says, "The ultimate question the man of responsibility asks is not, how can I extricate myself heroically from the affair, but How is the coming generation to live? It is only in this way that fruitful solutions can arise, even if for the time being they are humiliating. In short, it is easier by far to act on abstract principle than from concrete responsibility. The rising generation will always instinctively discern which of the two we are acting upon, for it is their future which is at stake. So if you find yourself having to choose from high moral principle or concrete responsibility, be responsible. Don't run away from that responsibility. The mud and the muck and the blood will wash off. The shame of standing aside while others suffer and you do nothing will not. So thanks, Lloyd, and the rest of the Armed Lutheran radio team for reminding me of that. Check them out at armedlutheran.us. Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that the Gunblog Variety Cast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode115.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you. This is a URS production.